Hello, this is Mental Podcast. Sorry about the long break since last year. As I said before, I was in Edinburgh Fringe in August, so I was really busy. And when I came to Berlin, I decided to turn pro on my comedy career, and that really carried me away. And I was didn't have the capacity to do the podcast for a while, but today I have Melanie back on the podcast, and she will interview me about my mental health. And since our talk last year in May, lots of things happened. So hopefully, Melanie can have a nice chat with me and unfold all the learnings and everything happened since last year. Oh, Melanie, it's your time.
I'm sure it'll be easy. Yeah, thank you for having me back for the third time now. Actually, technically speaking, the fourth time. Super
Yeah.
nice. Yeah, it's always a pleasure to be back here talking to you and to connect and just kind of see where we're at. It's really nice to observe our journeys. Yeah, so I was not aware of the fact that it had been almost a year. So I would love to know and start first off with the festival, with Fringe Festival, and how that experience was for you to leave, because you said you also took a break from the podcast. So let's start there. What happened over the summer with the festivals that you went to, and how did that impact your return in Berlin and your focus basically in the comedy world?
Oh, that the Edinburgh Festival was the best time in my life. I never thought I would have so much fun. Of course, there was lots of breakdown in between, but overall, I was really living my life. It was so amazing. It was so amazing for a whole month. 3,000, more than 3,000 shows every day happened in Edinburgh, and my schedule there was like wake up, do comedy, and do comedy whole day then sleep. It was
Oh.
really great. It helped me so much. It helped me so much. On one hand, I had an artistic block before I went to Edinburgh, because for almost 1 year I was really focused on my first solo, and I didn't hit very hard on the open mic scene. So for a while, I remember it was like a June, July. I was talking with people. I'm like really afraid of to do open mics, because I realized I don't have new material, and I have stage fright. I feel very insecure. But in Edinburgh, I have so much stage time. You know, in Berlin, average comedian, even they hustle like two, three shows per night. It's a maximum 5 to 7 minutes. If they're lucky, 10 minutes a spot.
Wow.
So no matter how hard you try, it's like less than 20 minutes per day. And it's like 5, 6 hours. You just hustle all around the city, but maximum 20 minutes. But in Edinburgh, like I was doing my solo every day, and then I host a show. And then on top of that, I do 4 to 6 spots. And the spots in Edinburgh is so much longer. It's 10 minutes per spot. So compared with 20 minutes maximum in Berlin, I was doing like 120 to 150 minutes per day there. So it's really like
Wow.
exponentially grow. And every day, or even every like 2, 3 days, I feel I'm one step, one level above. Like I just evolve so fast. And every 2, 3 days, I feel, oh my God, I'm so much better now. Oh my God, I unblock something. Oh my God, like I learned a new skill. It's just so fast.
It's like a
And
comedy
before,
boot camp.
yes, it is exactly what it is. And you just go there, you hustle so hard, and when you come back, you are for sure a better comedian because of the stage time you get. So when I was there, I unblocked this stage fright. At the end of when I came out, before I went there, I had a stage fright, and I was really worried about my future, because I have my first solo, but I just don't know if I have the talent to create another solo. And I was also very insecure about my hosting. I only started hosting last year in February or something. So I was not like good at it before I went to Edinburgh. But when I came out, I'm a reliable host. I unblocked my create block, and I also built a backbone for my second solo show. So it was
Wait,
like
let me ask a quick question here. So what does it mean for you when you say I'm now a reliable host? What do you see were some of the main differences between before and after in hosting specifically?
First, I one thing very easy to track is that when I started hosting, because there are some comedians, especially native speakers, they are very good at improvising, talking with audience, because that's their like a main language, their native language, especially if they are an extroverted person. So when I started hosting, I was very insecure with my language. So before hosting, I was already doing comedy for 4 years, but mostly only material. So I can visit and revisit the language I use to make sure I don't make big mistake. And also because I'm like an introverted person, so talking with people is never my advantage. So when I started hosting, I was just doing my material with no interaction with audience whatsoever. It's like there's a wall between us. I stand in front of you, but I'm not interacting with you. Now I'm able to I constrain myself. I don't allow myself to do material when I host anymore. So when I host, it's all improvised. It's all like communicating with audience. So that's a very objective improvement. And also I understand how hosting work, what kind of structure, like how many meetings I can host, because when I just started hosting, I was just do. Sometimes we'll be really over time because I don't know what's the like host the perfect structure of how many meetings I do, what do I do to have a good flow. And over time, I know the rough numbers, how to compose a good show. So timing wise, I'm getting way better. And also now I have my flow, what to say at what time, to ensure like everyone can have a good time while maximize my profit. And I don't have stage fright anymore. Also, I have a better control over audience. Sometimes when the audience are not nice, now I have a better ways to control them to make sure they don't decrease the enjoyment of other audience.
Okay. All right. So you've gone pro essentially. you worked out the kinks, and now you can kind of host and perform your own material in a more integrative way. But so how did that work out in your return in Berlin? So you said that you felt like you had just increased significantly on all accounts, in your skill set and also your confidence, no more stage fright. I can imagine that that allowed you to step on stage a lot more often also, given the fact that you're just not so nervous about it anymore. So how was it returning to like the fall season in Berlin with this like amped up skill set, and also in terms of your confidence level and in terms of your how do you say, like your inner desire to kind of show up in what you're doing? How did that shift? How did that shift over the fall time, and what new what new focus did it bring into your work?
So when I was on unemployed money last year. And when I came back to Berlin, the unemployment money ended. So I was really, really nervous about the future. I was like, okay, let's see how far I can go with the money I have, if I can make it work. And on one hand, the profile I built, Edinburgh really boosts my credibility as an artist, and I start to get way better offers for venue and slot. So from last year, I was doing this tiny Herman's Shoes bar with like 18 people maximum. And now I have like a regular shows every Saturday and Sundays. Saturday is like 45 people capacity, and Sunday is like 100 people. And also in the past, I was like, oh, I'm not confident I can do more than one show per night, because every time after one show, I'm already exhausted. But because of Edinburgh, I'm like, I can do anything. I did like everything in Edinburgh. I can do anything in Berlin. So I start to intensively host. Like now my Saturday and Sunday shows are all two shows, double shows per night. And by doing that, my Friday, very often Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I do two shows each night. So I do six shows per weekend.
But and, two shows in the same venue or in different venues?
Yeah, okay. The same venue. So I have one slot from the venue, and I maximize the profit by running two shows a night.
So do you do one like early night, and then there's like a late night show?
Yeah. That's smart. And it's just exponentially increased, because in the past I do maximum one show per week, and now I do like 20 shows, around 20 shows per month. And because my hosting and not only hosting but my producing like ability increased so much, how to give the right expectation to the audience, and how to communicate, and how to do the bucket speech and everything. So the my shows are so much more profitable than before. And also I do so much more shows. So overall now I'm at a very comfortable place financially, which I really didn't expect at the beginning. I thought I really would struggle for very long, but it really scared up. And now I'm not worried about money anymore. I can comfortably live with the money I earn. And knowing this is just so happy, because it's not about money itself, but it's also about my point of view on the future. I'm no longer insecure. I'm not scared anymore, because I know, okay, I can make this work. So I am a full-time comedian. I am a full-time artist. I'm making this work, and over time, I just get better and better. So I can focus at the moment instead of in the past. I worry about the future or how can I survive. So mental health-wise, it's really, really good for me.
I can imagine that. It gives you such a sense of stability, of stability, knowing that the thing you love doing the most can pay your bills, and that it's not anymore this matter of like, it's the difference between being a struggling artist and just a fully embodied artist. Yeah. So when, you know, this is something that I think is something, it's really something that most artists struggle with. It's like, while you're struggling to make the money to make ends meet, you also can't really create at your full potential, because you're constantly worried about where your next money is coming from. And so once you have that covered, you can also create from a place that's much more inspired, because it's also more free flowing, you know, because you're just focusing on what you want to create, and you know the rest is going to come.
Yeah, because so in order to create good art, I need to be in flow. Yeah. But if I'm so stressed all the time about surviving, I cannot be 100% focused. That will definitely decrease the quality of my art.
Do you feel like this is something that you would potentially in the future want to somehow teach to other comedians or other artists? This thing, like, you know, maybe like in the form of a masterclass or something like this, like this kind of the art of making money with, like, from what you love, or something like that?
I think we talked before the recording started. I think Maybe that will happen, but only in like 15, 20 years, because
Wow.
right now, like, I am just having so much fun discover
Yeah.
myself, and to teach, it's just how do you say it, deduct my energy, which I can focus on doing what I'm doing now.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. And so what is something that happened over the winter for you? Like, because this has been going now steadily over the whole winter, correct? Okay. So you've been in steady flow, money is flowing steadily. You're still in a relationship? Is this the same relationship you were in before?
Yes, the same
Okay.
relationship.
It
I
has deepened.
encouraged I encouraged him to quit his software developer job end of last year. Now he's a struggling artist.
Okay, so you took him through the struggle, but is he happy that way? And are you both are you planning on becoming some kind of like a comedy power couple or something like that, or are you liking to keep things separate?
He's struggling about money a lot. But on the other hand, he has his sugar girlfriend, so I'm paying a lot for him. I think this is also very empowering, because growing up, I would never imagine myself to be a sugar mommy. I think it's very empowering for me. I am like, yeah, I have the money. I would like to, I'm earning more. I think it makes sense for me to pay more. But on the other hand, he needs to find his way how to make this work financially. We like to keep things separate, because personality-wise, we are very different. I'm very like pushy, and I am, and he's more like relax and like chilled. And when we work together, I get angry very often. And I just realized that, for example, I have some part-time work. I would rather hire someone else than him, because when I hire him, I get angry. I need someone who can work better with me, who's more proactive.
Yeah, it's also probably better for the relationship to some extent to keep certain things like that separate, because it can really cause a lot more conflict than is necessary, because you're mixing the kind of like romantic element with this like work ambition element, and those don't necessarily always have to be harmonious, as long as you can keep them separately. But
And also, in as artists, like we have different style. If we work together, because I'm so much more advanced, I just push him go to my style, which is not healthy. He should figure out his own style.
Do you think that this is generally a tendency amongst comedians or artists in general? When you become successful at the way that you're doing things, that you tend to think it's the way to be successful is your way, or
I
no?
think it's for most of people, and I don't know many comedian couples, but I think once you are successful, you think, oh, that's the only way, but there are many ways. And I think if you are still on the way, you need to, whatever advice people give you need to take a grain of salt, because when they tell you, they are just thinking about their own journey, but you are different. Everyone have their own way. For example, when I was struggling, there's like a more experienced comedian talking in quite an arrogant way, and I feel very not happy about it. And then I had to do lots of mental work to realize, okay, what they said is not true. It worked for them, but that's not the only way to success. And I don't want to success like their way. I want to do my way.
What is for you? What became for you now your definition of success? Do you feel like it changed over the last year? Or do you feel like it got refined?
It definitely changed, you know, like besides the comedy thing, another very big event happened in my life. My father died last year.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Don't worry, listen to he I only met him like two, three times. He's not a good father. But when he died, he had a little bit of inheritance left. And I was permanently in debt, like as long as I can remember. And after my mom, she borrowed so many money to finance my study. And over the past years, as long as I had a job, every month I was paying her for 1,000 euros. And you can imagine how much money is that, like. And so for the past year when I was working on comedy, it's not only about, oh, I need to survive to become like a full-time artist, but also about, oh, I need to earn a surplus of, on top of me surviving, I need to earn a surplus of 1,000 euros to pay my mom as a comedian.
Wow.
That's really such incredible difficult task, and
Yeah.
that created so much stress for me. So the fact that my father died, his inheritance can pay back all the remaining loan my mom has, means I don't need to take care of my mom anymore. So I only need to cover myself and I'm good. And that really changed my mindset on comedy. For example, last year I was hustled really, really hard on media, on like a relationship with some like producing companies. I really, really wanted to break through to become famous, because that's what I thought the only way I can reach to a place financially I can afford being a full-time comedian. But because the father dad covered my mom, and now I can, like, financially I'm comfortable with my own living, so I don't want to be famous at all now. Like, I just want to do my art, and fame I don't care at all. And I do ho want to be famous as late as possible, because I'm only 5 years in. In order to really call myself a comedian, it's at least 10 years. I still have 5 years to go to really become a comedian. So I'm not in a rush to be famous at all. I just want to learn the skill to be better and better at it. And if I get famous too early, it's just more harmful to my art than the beneficial, because once I get famous, I would have an audience to buy my ticket. No matter what, then I will lose the ability to perform in front of a neutral audience. And lots of comedians who have that too fast, they will end up, whatever should they say, audience laugh it, and they don't know what's funny, what's not funny anymore. So
That's interesting.
they will have seen our show, and audience all have a great time. But for people who are not their fan, look their stuff, they were like, this is shit.
Oh, that's very interesting. Okay, so let me break that down, or like kind of deconstruct it a little bit, because okay, so let so this thing that you said of like 5 years in, how do you know for a fact that it's 10 years in, that after 10 years you can call yourself a comedian? Like, what is that based off of?
It's just an industrial rule of thumb.
Okay, it's an industry rule of thumb, right? Because it's 10 years, what it takes to gain the experience of being on stage, of connecting to different audiences, of touring, of bombing probably a lot, and then also coming up with new material all the time, testing it, figuring out what material is shit, what material is really good, and then figuring out what is genuinely funny beyond the realm of your fans, correct? Okay, but you feel like after 5 years, you're not there yet. What do you feel?
I don't think I'm not, how do you say it? I just feel like the better, like I just want to hone my skills. And but on the other hand, I do feel like Berlin 5 years is very different than New York 5 years, because as a New York or London or how do you say LA comedian, for their first 2 years they probably can do two mics or maximum three mics a week, and when they perform they can only do 3 minutes, and the audience is all other comedians who want to do a spot, so they don't have a real audience. Like a maximum a week they can get 10 minutes on stage, But in Berlin, it's so much different. And right now in Berlin, like I do, each week I have around like 4 hours of stage time. And unless you are a comedian who's like touring like all the time, that's incredible amount of stage time, like 4 hours per week.
Yeah.
So I do feel very privileged in that sense.
So what have been, I have more and more questions all the time. Okay, so let's see. What have been for you your favorite audiences so far? I'm very curious because from these 4 hours a week, right? Like, not all the audiences are going to be the same. However, in Berlin, it seems to be the case that the audiences are predominantly just, quote unquote, just audiences and not actually aspiring comedians themselves or comedians who are trying to perform in the same venue. So what have been your favorite, what are for you your favorite audiences? Can you even determine that for yourself?
And of course.
Yeah. And then I'm also curious to hear in this development of like, okay, before you become famous, when you say you want to continue developing your craft, what exactly does that look like for you? Where is it that you see that you want to keep refining, and in what areas specifically? Because I feel like you're someone who also views your own work with the capacity of self-criticism, which I think is really important for an artist, as long as it doesn't go over to self-sabotage. So these two things, what are the audiences, and then what do you see needs to still be refined in order for you to feel like, oh, I'm fully embodying the profession of the comedian?
I think like for the audience, it's hard to say what kind of audience I like, but I do shows every weekend. So you really can tell, like sometimes the audience just don't work. Like this weekend, I had six shows. Out of six shows, five very good shows and two extraordinary shows and one really bad show. And at that bad show, there's a German, like white man, like a German alpha male, came to my show, keep talking in the front row again and again. I communicated with him like three, four times. He's still talking. And at the end, I have to say, if you keep doing this, I'm going to kick you out. And that really like bring down the whole vibe of the show. And now as a producer, I learned that sometimes when I'm checking people in, when I feel the person is weird and really like not right vibe, I just don't let them in. Because a show can only be good if the audience is there with me. If when I check you in, you are already angry, you are already mad, you are already disrespectful, like it's just bad experience for everyone involved. And with the skills, you say what I want to develop, I think it's very hard to say. You as a comedian, I realize lots of skills, I only know there's such skills once I acquire them.
Yeah, accurate. Yeah.
Like for example, for lots of beginner comedians, they think, oh, I'm good, but there's so many things they don't know, they don't have. But you can only know that they such thing exists once you have them. So it's very, very hard to say. It's a lot of very fine stuff. For example, regarding managing crowds. For example, on Friday, I had this German alpha male. At the end, the mood of the crowd went down because of the incident. But if I'm a better comedian, hopefully, like at some point, even a person like this, I can manage it. While make him to shut up, but not hurting everyone else's mood, and that.
I mean, I remember a few shows of like Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock and stuff where they actually turn that person into the joke. So they actually decide to just focus on that person and start taking a piss out of them because it becomes obvious that there's no other way to kind of shut that person down. So you actually turn them into the joke because then There's not
I
much they
think
can do.
you get a very good sense of this. This is actually the way to go. And that's also normally what I do. But that day, it's just that guy, he's so tall. He's like 2 meters tall. And obviously, it's an alpha male. He's super good looking. And the way he talks is just so arrogant. And, you know, like being me, such a small immigrant, like a woman of color. And, like I just have the anger in me and I couldn't control. But previously I had a similar audience who talk a lot, but they are not like so I don't see this like a social discrimination, you know, and I was able to make fun of them. But that day I just got a bit triggered because of the social difference. I just feel like I was being like not respected.
Perhaps it's also a thing that a lot of people forget about comedians is that actually in a way, for a comedian, also a performer, like an actor, for example, but I think more for a comedian because yes, you are performing, but you're not acting as somebody else. You're sharing pieces built on your life, right? On things that you've experienced, on thoughts that you've had. And I think that what's interesting about that is that people forget that when you're on stage, and there are people who trigger you. You don't stop being a human being because you're a performer. And maybe part of becoming a really established comedian, a really pro comedian or a pro performer of any kind, is to be able to actually manage situations like that really well. And that's really underestimated, actually, in terms of like how much training it requires. Being able to do that, how much inner training and how much inner resilience, because if it's not easy in day-to-day life, then imagine when you're on a stage with people watching you and you're trying to share something and you're distracted by someone who's triggering the shit out of you. You're trying to keep your cool and make people laugh while being triggered. That's not easy to manage.
Like for example, at my solos, sometimes there were I have hosts to manage the crowd to make sure, say, oh, please don't talk, please don't talk. But there's always a few like a chatty audience. And in the past, I'm like, just shut up. But now I learned that, say, okay, you are talking, like, please don't, you are talking, you distract me, I want to talk with you, but it's not fair for everyone here because when you distract me, I cannot 100% be in the moment to perform for everyone else. And please just be mindful for everyone else. And when I say it this way, they are way less like offended than I say, shut up.
This is, I mean, it makes sense because I think people just, I think in general, people don't like being called out for being rude, but it's also, I think, a big quest for all performers is to figure out how to stand your ground when on stage and make yourself be heard and respected, without creating tension in a room. And I think that
Yeah, that's really
that's an art
hard.
form. It's an art form in itself. Yeah. It's a bit like almost like hostage negotiation.
And now like when I say okay, instead of saying you are annoying, I'm like okay, if you dis you talk, you distract me, I cannot be my 100% decrease the enjoyment for everyone else. Then the audience they were like also attend the other audience with my side because I'm shutting them up not because I want it, it's because I want everyone all in this room have a good time.
Yeah, but there's also an element of empower and being able to do that. And I think perhaps that is also growth as a comedian is to be able to stand up for yourself when your art is not being appreciated and when also the thing you're trying to communicate with other people is not being able to land and arrive in other people's fields, so to say, because there's other people interfering there, right? And that there's an element of power there of being able to say, hey, I kindly ask you to please shut your mouth or go outside to talk because I'm trying to communicate something here and you're interfering with the signal kind of thing. And I feel like there's a lot of respect to be gained there for people, I think, especially for women, especially for women of color, especially for women who feel marginalized, generally for any person who is capable of standing up and making themselves be heard. That's something that's really important, and it takes growth of character more than growth of skill set. And that comes with experience. So I feel like that's something that I'm noticing for you since we last talked. It's become, for me really evident is like you've also grown a lot in terms of like your strength of character. Like you are becoming more mature and more developed also in terms of like feeling more centered of like who am I and what am I allowed to do in this world versus what have I been told that I'm allowed to do. Because I think that that's a little bit where we were at last year, because I remember you were pushing and struggling and struggling and struggling, and you were kind of having a bit of a meltdown. You were kind of in crisis about your organization, about how your brain was functioning. I remember we were talking a lot about like this struggle with ADD and trying to get all the pieces together, the bullet journal, all of this stuff. And it feels like now, you've landed in a place that is more calm in a way, but not calm in the sense of less productive, just calm in the sense of like knowing your shit and knowing how to bring it up into the world without it throwing you off guard all the time. So I'm curious, how did that actually happen? Like, what was the process in there? Because you also just coming out of like German winter. I'm surprised your motivation is like on point, because I feel like it's always really difficult for people in the Berlin
Like for
winter.
me, winter is not bad because winter is when comedy goes the best, and
That's true.
with all the money coming, I can't complain.
You're like, it's cold, but
How do you say it? I think success is the best way to build more success. Last year when we were talking, like everything in the future is a fog. It's a fog.
money.
Like I don't know what will happen. I wasn't making money at all. And I was surviving by unemployment fund, and I really don't know where is my place in life. Like I knew for sure I cannot work in a corporate job anymore, but I also didn't know if I can make it work as a comedian. So lots of self doubts and insecurity, but the fact that I can make comedy work now, I'm already earning like the same salary as my previous job, which is really impressive. Because I had a good job, and but doing things I 100% love and owning for myself, that builds lots of confidence. And I trust myself so much more. And when I have ideas, when I have something thoughts on future, I know, okay, I can just lean in, trust myself, let myself fall, because I know there's safe net. That is the core of myself, because I look back, every step I made in my adult life was right. And knowing where I come from and how much I achieved, now looking back, it's a trail of evidence that to tell me, okay, Moni, just chill, don't worry too much. You have it, you got it, and no matter what happened, you can nail it.
But also something that I wanted to put into the room, because honestly, just because I listened to a song earlier today and it asked this exact question, and I fucking loved it. It was like, oh, that's so good. So basically, the question is it really that you've gained confidence, or rather, have you gained clarity? The proposal is that as human beings, when we are focused a lot on, we have to become more confident, I have to work on my confidence, I have to work on my confidence as the motto, as the guiding light of what's going to bring you the success and what's going to kind of make life work for you, that this over focus on confidence is rather because you're lacking clarity. However, when you have clarity about where you're going, who you are, what you can and cannot do, what works and what doesn't work, when you have clarity, then the confidence is a natural byproduct of it. And you no longer need to build that confidence. It's actually that the confidence is already there. And the clarity is the thing that kind of leads you down the path. So I asked the question, do you feel like you've gained confidence, or is it rather like you've gained clarity?
I think it's just phonetic. I'm not sure if it's confidence or clarity. I just know I can trust myself.
I feel like that's clarity more than confidence. Because clarity is a knowing. Clarity is when things are clear to you. They're obvious. It's like, okay, I no longer doubt this. This is not a question anymore. It's clear. I can trust myself. It's a clear statement. And then the confidence comes from knowing that you can trust yourself, right? Okay. But I think it's a beautiful distinction to make, because I think especially when you struggle, you know, thinking about how this whole podcast began, right, for you, and when we met as well with like the Mental Health Festival, both of our journeys, I think we both went through this constant questioning of what is real, who am I, how do I get there, am I any good, you know, like all of these questions, and everything was constantly, as you said, it was in a fog. There was no clarity over anything. And so when you have no clarity and you're struggling with your mental health, oftentimes it might be because of that lacking clarity, because there's just confusion. And in confusion, you can't anchor yourself very well in anything, because it's like quicksand. It's constantly shifting.
By the way, I realize I have bipolar too.
That you what?
I have bipolar too.
Bipolar disease.
Yeah.
Or like disease disorder. How do you know this? Did you get it diagnosed? Or did you self-diagnose again?
No. This one is not self-diagnosed. Okay. My psychiatrist wanted to diagnose me twice already, and I thought he's crazy. So I'm like, no, I don't have it. And then in Edinburgh, I talked with a comedian who also have bipolar too. And I talk with her, and the more I talk with her, the more I feel, oh, that sounds like me. And I start to look into it. I realize, oh, I thought I don't have bipolar because I was thinking about bipolar 1, which I definitely don't have.
So let's go into the differences between these two, and also if and whether or not this plays into the ADD that you had kind of self-diagnosed and felt that was something that was really tripping you up. So what is the difference between bipolar 1 and bipolar 2?
So bipolar 1, I cannot like explain 100% correct, but from what my understanding is, that bipolar 1 is like when you are like on the manic phase, you go full in, like you like it's like you are out of reality, like this kind of thing. Bipolar 2 is more like sometimes you are really energetic and sometimes very depressed, and it's like a recurring depression, like always coming back. I read some books, really helpful. And I was really surprised. From what I read, like a very large proportion of depression, people who have depression, actually they are bipolar too. But the issue is, when the psychiatrist prescribe people with bipolar two with antidepressant, is really dangerous, because it can push those people with bipolar 2 to manic phase, which is very, very unhealthy. And the main treatment for bipolar 2 is, the goal is to not like make you not depressed. The goal is to reduce the mood swing, because the swing part is the worst. So I don't know if it's the reason, but I start to take a mood stabilizer end of last year. Mm-hmm. And since last year, end of last year to now, it's like a quarter mm-hmm. of a year. I had a few days like a feeling down, but I haven't been depressed.
Have you felt, however, your sense of joy has also decreased?
No. Yeah.
So it's just the mood swings. Because how long was it usually when you were in a down phase? How long was it lasting for usually?
Oh, for me, it's a like a edge case. Maybe that's why it also took me so long to realize. For normal people, like a mood swing is like between a few months to a few years. But I was an edge case of rapid cycling, so I can go like a few days to a few weeks.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the ADD, though, that you had kind of self-diagnosed yourself with was not the case. It was not actually diagnosed, or was that also kind of
I didn't get an official diagnosis, But I talk with my therapist and my psychiatrist. They were like, "Yeah, that sounds like." But I don't want to go through the diagnose phase because there's no biologic test. It's only in questionnaires, and they check your past history, which I don't have because I come from China.
Yeah.
And to get the diagnosis like that, the only benefit is only that I can get the ADHD like a
medication.
Journey.
Yeah.
And I don't need that. I'm happy with all the like mental tools I have, and now my life is in place. I don't need the medication, so I don't think there's a need for me to go through the diagnosis because it takes a lot of paperwork. And when you have ADHD, you know to do paperwork in a language you don't know. It's the worst kind of treatment.
Yeah, but also, do you feel like getting diagnosed with bipolar 2 and then receiving mood stabilizers for that also assisted you in stabilizing certain effects of the ADD in terms of like, what I found is that when you're emotionally going through a lot of up and down swings, it's much more difficult to become stable in your workflow. Because you can't concentrate as much on what you're doing because your moods are going up and down all the time. So you having to spend a lot of actual energy, and in terms of like nervous system regulation, a lot of your focus is going to regulating your nervous system down first before you can even get into focus mode. So is it so that ingesting and taking mood stabilizers kind of naturally helped you also balance out your workflow?
I think yes and no. I don't think it naturally balanced my workflow, but for sure I think it reduced like my days of being depressed, because in the past every a few months or a few like a few months, like 2-3 months, I would have an episode last a week to 2 weeks where I cannot do anything and just breaking down. But I haven't had this for, I think, at least like 3-4 months now. That really helped with my workflow because when I break down, I cannot do anything. But on the other hand, my ADD is really out of control because I learned a few tricks. One is, as we said last time, the bullet journal method, it really helps me. Every day I have my routine and all the tasks I need to do, I just follow through. And on top of that, I read a book last year, also by Johan Hari. He has a new book called Stolen Focus. And in this book, he introduced two tools. One is an app, desktop app called the Freedom App. So basically, I turn this software on. I have a list of websites, like a time waster website. Once I set the timer on, I say, okay, the next 2 hours I want to work. Then I turn it on, then there's no way I can access to my email, my Facebook, my social media, Amazon or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I have a box. It's called a Kitchen Safe.
Yeah, you mentioned this, where you put your phone in, right? And you can't access it.
Yeah, I put my phone in. So it's a time locker. So I, for example, I say, okay, every day I learn German for 1 hour. And before that happens, I'm just set a timer on Freedom App for 1 hour to lock my computer and also set a timer for my phone. So when that happens, I have nothing else to do. I can just work.
Yeah, and that it reduces the amount of stressors that you have from other apps and different devices.
Yeah, because there's no mental rationalization anymore. There's no conversation. Oh, maybe just now. I know there's no way I can access it. So it's all okay. The chatter in my brain, it just shut down.
Yeah, that was interesting. Where I am right now, also in the mountains, because now I changed rooms and I'm in a room that actually has internet, but I was in the other house and the other house didn't have any Wi-Fi. You also didn't have signal, like you didn't have a phone signal or anything. And it was very interesting to observe the instinctual urge that a lot of us have to just kind of like in the evening or something to want to like pick up your phone and check your messages or write someone or scroll through Instagram or whatever it is, and picking up my phone and then being like, oh yeah, I can't do this. This is like pointless. There's no internet here. Just putting it back down and then kind of just sitting with your thoughts and realizing that that urge actually just comes from a desire to fill time with something, and not because you actually need it in that moment, that there's anything that's really relevant there for you. Although some of it did feel relevant because I was trying to figure out where I was going to stay and live and all this, like a lot of things that were of a pragmatic nature, which is why I switched rooms to be able to kind of pursue those things. But it's really interesting how that changes your perception, right? Of like, how much can your brain focus when you're not being distracted by other things?
Do
But
you,
also
well,
you.
I have a question. Do you have
Yes.
sometimes in the evenings, like you just mindless scrolling on your phone and you realize you are not enjoying the time at all, but you also cannot control yourself?
Sometimes, so this is something I observed for myself. So I realized when I'm in an environment that I don't enjoy, and I'm kind of going through some days where like I just don't feel comfortable, like I don't feel engaged with the place and the people and everything, then I'm more likely to pick up my phone and try to avoid the feeling of discomfort that I have by scrolling through my phone. And scrolling and looking at things, but then I will actually stop and read a lot of things that have to do with like self-care or waking myself up. And it's almost as if there's a subconscious mechanism in my case where I'm going to certain platforms in order to find the text or the video or whatever that will kind of wake me the fuck up. You know what I mean? It will kind of give me that slap of like, oh shit, right, yeah. And then as soon as I see it, I'm like, damn it. Okay. And then I just put my phone away and then I don't know, sit down and journal or something, or I'll sit down with the feeling. But what I notice is when I'm in places or with people that I enjoy, I literally have zero urge to have my phone. Like I co-hosted a retreat here this entire last week, and it was pretty hilarious because I took one photo in 7 days of a retreat because I was just really present with everything that was happening. And like I didn't, the only time I grabbed my phone was to talk to my partner and like to video call, you know, but that's it. And like I felt like there was just no need really to have any kind of distractions because so much had happened during the day that I was also just processing it in the evening. But yeah, it's definitely a thing when I'm in a place that I feel uncomfortable with. Then
When that
yes,
happened
it's
to
like
me,
self-soothing. It's like self-soothing, you know what I mean? It's like food or something, or smoking weed or something like that. You know, you're self-soothing. Sorry,
So
go ahead.
I often just in the evening when that happened to me, I just lock the phone.
Yeah, I mean, I just put it away. I'll just put it away most of the time and then just be like, oh, let's let this go, like whatever. But I also noticed that like when you change your environment and you're generally in environments that are like more nature ridden, for example, you're less likely to be on your phone. I don't know why. I honestly just don't know what the connection is. I haven't really figured it out for myself, but I just noticed that when I'm in nature, I have zero desire to be on my phone. But it just
Because you
doesn't
have
happen.
that connection with your environment.
Yeah, because my environment is much more interesting than whatever's going on in the phone, you know? But in general, I also noticed that the more you are on your phone, the more, yeah, there's that dopamine effect, right? That's kind of targeted as well, specifically from social media to people's brains. Like the idea is that you do consume it in a way that feeds into your brain, this dopamine effect where you want to continue consuming more, even if you're not really interested in what you're consuming. And so I think the quest is to become aware of when are you consuming and why. I wanted to ask you something as well regarding the mood swings and the mood stabilizers, and certain habits. So I was curious to know, do you still smoke weed? Is that something that you had to quit? Did you take it out altogether? Are you still doing it regularly? What is the deal with that? And how does it, what has been your exploration of that consumption in relation to your stabilizing moods and or
That's
destabilizing moods?
a very good question, actually. I've been smoking every day for almost 5 years now, and I had a little bit of downtime in February. And I realized, oh, January I did great. I realized because January I take a sober January. And when I start to smoke weed every day, it went, all went downhill. I thought I can function, but no, not really. And since a few weeks ago, since February, I lock my weed 6 days per week. Only on my free day I can smoke. But actually, just 2 days ago, I reached to a conclusion. I don't like that I just mindlessly smoke weed because I can. And I now I have such better, I barely watch TV, watch YouTube. But on Monday, I smoke weed because Monday was my free day. I smoke weed, then immediately I start to watch YouTube. And I'm like, I don't even enjoy it that much. And now I'm taking a 3 month break, and after that I think what I want to do is to not smoke for the sake of smoke, not because I can, but only on very special occasion. Weed has been very beneficial to me for many years, but I was at a very different place. I was depressed, I was isolated, I was unable to feel joy. And the weed helped me to get through the time. But now I have a fulfilling, a personal and a professional life. I cannot afford to stone down my couch every night watching TV. I want to do more productive things. And I think I don't think weed is bad, but I just think people change, time change. I'm no longer in that phase that I need it every day anymore.
Yeah, and I can also imagine that, or what I've experienced is that it's kind of a double-sided sword, because on the one hand, weed can be really stabilizing for your mood in the sense that it kind of if you're high or you're stoned, you're not necessarily experiencing your emotions in the same peaks that you usually would, so it can actually regulate you in a certain way. But I also have questioned a lot of times whether it actually, on the long term, actually dysregulates you even more, because when you're not actually feeling the peaks of the emotions, it's also the case that as soon as you stop smoking weed for a few days, your whole system kind of goes haywire, because you're all of a sudden feeling everything much more intensely. There isn't that regulation method, and you have to kind of have already other tools to fall back on, or else it becomes a bit of a mess, you know? And then that can be a bit of a
I think for me, I don't have that. I can easily stop, and I don't have any side effect when I stop. I think for me, it's more about a phase in life, different phases in life. I was like when I started smoking weed, I was suicidally depressed. I was permanently isolated at a job, at an environment I didn't enjoy, I wasn't good at, in a place where I almost had no friend. And so weed really helped me to get through all those negative factors in life to so to make me to survive, to find still able to not suffer too much, to get through the day. But now time has changed. I am in a great life. I do what I love for a living, doing well financially, living in a great place with a loving partner, two dogs, and having a supporting community. And I in the past in the evening I have time to kill. I need to pass through the time, otherwise I want to fucking kill myself. But now in the evening, I want to do yoga. I want to spend time with my dogs. I want to read. I want to do so many meaningful things. I don't want to pass time anymore.
There's nothing to escape from anymore. Yeah, that's beautiful. And it's beautiful to see that that's something that happened quite organically, that it didn't require this kind of like crash and burn, hit rock bottom situation for you to say, okay, I have to stop this, because I think that sometimes can be the case with certain habits like weed. So it's really sweet to see. that it's kind of naturally morphed. But yeah, we got to wrap it up because we've been talking for quite a bit of time. And I feel like we've gotten all a really good view of the fact that you have fucking been mastering at life right now. And then you've come definitely on this journey from being at a very low point and kind of going up and going back down again and then going up again, that now you're kind of catching this stabilized place on the upwards curve. And that's really, really cool, really inspiring to see. And I'm very curious about what the future will bring for you and what kind of countries, cities, continents you'll be conquering next.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Very happy to have you back to interview me again. I know last time anytime. I said let's do this regularly, but let's see if this time we can actually make it regularly to have a semi-regular checkup to mm-hmm. talk about it. And I think at one point I also want to invite you back on the podcast because you also progressed so much in the past year. Very happy and very grateful for the conversation. And yeah, have a good time.
Thank you. Me too. Anytime. I'm always glad to be back. And yeah, enjoy the rest of your time. And then we will catch back into each other soon.
Yeah, cool. Bye. Have a good day.